This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
this G7 will be looking at many issues in the next couple of days, including migration. Now, there are concerns that this will be one of the most divisive G summits that have ever taken place.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna at the G7 summit. Details coming up.
Also, the UN Children's Fund is urging G7 leaders to adopt an action plan to keep refugee and migrant children safe. And armed Islamic militants opened fire at a bus at a monastery in the south of Egypt, killing over 24 Coptic Christian pilgrims.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, nearly 30 Coptic Christian pilgrims traveling to a monastery in the south of Egypt were killed today when suspected Islamic militants opened fire on a stopped passenger bus. Coptic sources say that many of the passengers were women and children, as Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Women wailed as family members of the victims gathered outside the Magaga Hospital in the southern Egyptian town of Minya, close to where the terror attack took place Friday morning. Egyptian media said the victims were pilgrims who were on a journey to the monastery of the Prophet Samuel, revered and visited by Coptic Christians across Egypt. A woman survivor told Egyptian TV from her hospital bed that the group's bus was ambushed by terrorists. She says that their bus was carrying around 40 pilgrims and that they were attacked by a group of armed men. Video on Egyptian media showed a passenger bus which appeared to have its windows blown out by gunfire. Coptic sources said the masked gunmen opened fire at the bus at close range after forcing it to come to a stop. Other sources claimed that the gunmen entered the bus seeking to kill survivors. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi called an emergency meeting of his security cabinet immediately after reports of the attack. Sisi recently denounced Islamic terror groups and those that support them during a summit in the Saudi capital of Riyadh, attended by U.S. President Donald Trump and leaders of close to 50 other Arab and Islamic states. Coptic Christians have been targeted in a number of recent terror attacks across Egypt, including two suicide attacks on Coptic churches in the Nile Delta town of Tanta and the port city of Alexandria. Nearly 50 people were killed in those attacks. A suicide bomber also blew himself up in the main Coptic Christian cathedral of St. Mark's in Cairo last December. Terrorists in the Sinai Peninsula have systematically targeted Christians in the port town of Arish, killing them with gunshots and in some cases burning their bodies. Many Copts have fled the Sinai for towns on the other side of the Suez Canal. Terror researcher Maher Feghali told Egyptian TV that the attackers were probably from the group calling itself Beit al-Maqdis, now describing itself an affiliate of the Islamic State group, which he says has supporters in the Sinai as well as the region of Minya, where the Friday attack took place. He says that terrorists with ties to the Muslim Brotherhood usually attack only Egyptian police and security forces, while terrorists belonging to the so-called Beit al-Maqdis group have frequently attacked Coptic Christians. He adds that these terrorists have bases in both the Sinai and in the south of Libya. He says they use little-traveled desert roads to go back and forth between the area around Minya where the attack took place. Terrorists in the same region also targeted Coptic Christians during an Islamic insurgency during the 1990s. Islamic terror groups have been trying to foment a sectarian conflict between Muslims and Christians, so far without success. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
World leaders have gathered today in the Sicilian resort town of Taormina for the summit of the Group of Seven Nations, or G7 Summit. The summit is the first for U.S. President Donald Trump. Some leaders are concerned the meeting will be divisive given Trump's stand on issues such as migration and climate change. Reporter Josephine McKenna is at the G7 summit. She spoke with me about some of the hot topics on the agenda.
Well, as you may know, Taormina here in Sicily is really at the crossroads of Europe and Africa and the Middle East. It's been conquered over the centuries by Romans, Greeks, and plenty of other people as well. Now it is really at the center of the migrant crisis. And this G7 will be looking at many issues in the next couple of days, including migration. Now, there are concerns that this will be one of the most divisive G summits that have ever taken place. President Donald Trump is at his first G7. Will he be the spoiler? We know he's taken a very hard line on migrants. He's made it clear he doesn't want to see any declaration that talks about welcoming migrants or any sort of extra sympathy or care for migrants. He's got a very different line on global trade. He wants to see greater protection and bilateral trade for the US. And so far, he's unwilling to commit on climate change and endorse the Paris Climate Accord. So really a very controversial summit, and it's still unclear what they will come up with in their final declaration. But certainly migration is one of the big issues here.
Tomorrow, the African leaders are expected to arrive. What is the agenda going to be when they come in?
Well, when the African leaders join this summit on the sidelines, we will see leaders from Kenya, Ethiopia, Niger, and Nigeria. And there will be opportunities for European leaders to have bilateral talks with them. The French President Emmanuel Macron and the Italian Prime Minister Paolo Gentiloni have already indicated that they think economic development in Africa is critical to building a future for African countries and also trying to deter thousands of people, as we know, making that journey through Libya across the Mediterranean. We've had 2,000 arrivals in Italy in the last 24 hours. So that concern about immigration and promoting economic development is critical here for the EU partners and these African countries. And that's something that they will be looking at in the next day or so.
Also, France's new president will be meeting with a couple of African leaders. What do you expect from these meetings?
People say that it's the dialogue, the face-to-face dialogue at these summits that really make the difference rather than the large meetings. And for these leaders to be here to hear what the European leaders are trying to do and understand the scale of the problem and talk about possible ways of promoting development in their own countries is really critical, because Italy is expecting around 200,000 arrivals in 2017, and it's very concerned about the number of unaccompanied children who are making that terribly dangerous journey, while also some concern there about what's going on in Libya and the possibility after the Manchester attack that we're seeing some sort of ISIS foothold developing in Libya. That's also of concern both to African countries and to Europe.
That was Josephine McKenna speaking with me from the resort town of Taormina, Sicily.
Following Donald Trump's meeting with Pope Francis this week, there was a brief mention that the U.S. president was committed to fighting famine. The Associated Press says it was mentioned in the last paragraph of a brief White House statement on the meeting. It says the United States is proud to announce more than $300 million in anti-famine spending focused on the crisis in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, and Nigeria. However, it's not clear what future U.S. spending will be on emergency food aid, since the Trump administration is calling for large budget cuts. The administration says it does not plan to eliminate money for food aid, just consolidate it into a bigger program that covers all international disaster assistance. However, the AP says the move actually would reduce the amount of money spent on fighting famine to $1.5 billion next year, down from more than $2.5 billion last year. The final figure for this fiscal year is not yet known.
The UN Children's Fund is urging G7 leaders meeting in Taormina, Sicily, to adopt an action plan to keep refugee and migrant children safe. UNICEF reports at least 200 refugee and migrant children, mostly from sub-Saharan Africa, have died this year along Mediterranean sea routes from North Africa to Italy. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Data from early 2017 shows a growing number of refugees and migrants are taking the perilous central Mediterranean route to reach Europe. According to UNICEF, more than 45,000 people, including some 5,500 unaccompanied and separated children, have arrived in Italy by sea. That is 44% higher than last year. Speaking by phone from Sicily, UNICEF Deputy Executive Director Justin Forsyth says far too many children, more than one a day, are literally dying trying to get to Italy. And those who make it suffer starvation, beatings, and slave-like conditions before and during the journey. He says unaccompanied children who spoke to a doctor after their arrival in the Italian seaport of Lampedusa in the last 3 days paint a picture of horror and abuse by smugglers who ferried them across the sea.
One young Eritrean girl, he said, was so traumatized. She'd been raped before embarking and on her journey. We know Libya is particularly challenging for young women. He also, for those a young boy, who had visible signs of torture.
UNICEF reports the number of children seeking asylum in Europe between 2008 and 2016 has grown from 1 in 5 to 1 in 3. Most come from Eritrea, Gambia, Nigeria, Egypt, and Guinea. The Italian G7 presidency is making migration a priority for this year's talks. Forsyth says even if the leaders cannot agree on the wide migrant and refugee crisis, it is hoped they will agree on something practical to help children who are most vulnerable. UNICEF's six-point agenda for action includes a call for protection of refugee and migrant children from exploitation and violence, the end of detention for child asylum seekers, and keeping families together. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
On November 27th of last year, Uganda's People Defense Forces raided a cultural institution in the Ruwenzururu Kingdom Palace in western Uganda. During the raid, the government says 103 people were killed, including 16 police officers. The local king and 150 of his subjects were arrested and charged with treason, terrorism, and murder. The group Human Rights Watch insists nearly 170 innocent civilians were killed in the raid, including 15 children. Maria Burnett is the Associate Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. She spoke with reporter Halima Atumani about the HRW report released today demanding an international independent investigation into the killings.
It's really important that there must be justice, there must be investigations, there must be accountabilities, because we have not seen progress in the last 6 months since these killings took place.
You mentioned that you need an independent investigation into these matters. Who in particular are you aiming at?
Well, if the government had played its part and carried out a meaningful and credible investigation at the time of the killings, there might not be the need for international support. But I think what's clear at this point is that the government has shown a real unwillingness to investigate what occurred. There has been the offer from international partners, from various EU countries and from the United States to offer support. So what we are calling on the government to do is to receive that support, to work with those donors, to ensure that the justice that occurs for Kasese can be credible. But as a middle step, a representative like the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings could be invited to come in to establish a fact pattern of what occurred that could pave the way to build trust with local communities. There's no doubt that in waiting for so long, the government faces an uphill battle. The communities don't trust government at this point.
Previously, the government has come out and said the shooting that was done by security forces was lawful. Why are you still insisting that it was not lawful, that they should be investigated?
Because the analysis of the use of force and what amount of force is warranted should be done looking at exactly what was happening in the palace at the time that the conflict occurred. When we have raised issues around the use of force and the unwarranted use of lethal force, government actors start are talking to me about violence in 2014 or 2015. If government had isolated individuals who they believe had perpetrated crimes, they should carry out law enforcement operations. They could arrest those individuals and charge them before courts of law. But there is nothing that gives them the right to step into a space and start using lethal force and shooting people down. Uganda's police force, for example, has been heavily equipped by various international donors with non-lethal means. We have seen those non-lethal means throughout the campaign period with water cannons and tear gas used on opposition rallies. So why did we see people in Kasese die in a hail of bullets?
The last time you released the statement, the government said there were only 103 people who were killed. Now you're saying it's 150, 180.
The problem is that they've changed the death toll every time we have pushed them, and also they've never been very clear about over what period of time they are talking. Clearly, we know that there were some deaths in the days leading up to the weekend where the most violence occurred. In some cases, they seem to include the killings of the police officers. In other cases, they don't include that number. In some cases, they include the 8 Royal Guards killed on the Saturday, and in some cases, they talk only of the Sunday. So ultimately, it's very difficult to rely on the government figures. We have tried to be very specific about what we believe to be the case based on our research. We are very concerned that our numbers are conservative, and that's what we hope will come out of a good investigation, that the true numbers will be unearthed and that families will feel that they know the true story of how their loved ones died.
Talking about numbers, you still insist that there were 15 children who went missing, but the government says there was no children.
I've spoken to the families. The families have spoken of the missing children. We've spoken to people from the local schools who say that these children are missing. There were children charged in the criminal case who ultimately were released on remand. So I think there's no doubt that there were children in the palace that day. The government can try to dispute whether they were killed or not, but I don't understand how they can come to that conclusion without actually doing an investigation.
According to the government, this matter is before court, so discussing it is definitely sub judice. Why do we see Human Rights Watch still discussing the matter?
The sub judice rule just simply does not apply. It's a convenient way of diverting attention or trying to silence civil society or families demanding justice. But that rule is to try to ensure that evidence that is before court is not discussed outside of court. Ultimately, there is no investigation into the conduct of soldiers. There are no pending charges before court. That rule also does not apply to people who are not parties before the matter. And as civil society, we always have the right to speak up and demand more from governments, whether it's the Ugandan governments or other governments around the world.
That was Maria Barnett, Associate Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. She spoke with reporter Halima Atumani in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib, 23 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Armed and masked Islamic militants opened fire at close range at a bus in south of Egypt, killing over two dozen Coptic Christian pilgrims. U.S. President Donald Trump is attending the G7 summit for the first time in the Sicilian resort town of Taramina. And the UN Children's Fund is urging G7 leaders to adopt an action plan to keep refugee and migrant children safe. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
While the civil war and humanitarian crisis in South Sudan grow worse, much of the country's wildlife has found some safe havens, at least so far. That's according to the first aerial assessment of the conflict's effects on wildlife. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Wildlife Conservation Society issued its report based on an aerial survey done in 2015 and 16. Two Cessna aircraft, flying at 300 feet, surveyed parts of South Sudan, scene of the world's second largest land mammal migration after the Serengeti. Dr. Paul Elkin is a senior conservationist for the WSC.
Because we've been working there for almost a decade now, 10 years, we have a sense of where the hotspots are and where the conflicts are. And of the set of 10 or more key wildlife areas, we were able to focus on at least 50% of them and get the job done.
Local communities were notified of the operation to allay any fears when the planes flew overhead.
They know us and they're used to our work there.
Among the animals surveyed were elephants, giraffes, lions, and hippos. Elkins says the survey planes flew over the central and southern parts of South Sudan, on both sides of the Nile River.
Because the heavy fighting at the time and continues was mostly in the northern reaches, so we couldn't get into those zones for fear of being shot down. But we were able to safely access these other areas. So it's Boma Park, Bandingalo Park, Southern National Park, as well as some areas on the border with Kenya and Uganda and Ethiopia. So those were the key zones.
The survey found there were at least 730 elephants in the surveyed zones. Before the Civil War, in December 2013, the South Sudan Wildlife Services estimated there were about 2,300 elephants in the entire country. In the 1970s, there were nearly 80,000. Giraffes are reported in low numbers, several hundred compared to 13,000 in the early 80s. Despite that, Elkin is encouraged by what they found.
One never knows what you're going to find out there. And so these elephants and the giraffe, and obviously we have been losing some in some areas, but the fact that we have considerable numbers left show that the remoteness of the zone and, frankly, the species are able to find pockets of security despite the conflict and raging in different places.
But Elkin admits he's very concerned about wildlife in the conflict areas.
We certainly can't expect to find the encouraging results in these other more conflicted zones that we've found in the less impacted zones. And we do have reports from early 2016 from some of these northern areas of some pretty significant elephant poaching incidences of 10 and 15 animals killed at a time. Let's hope that they find the same way of surviving in the northern zones as they did in the center and the south.
Besides poaching and ivory trafficking, South Sudan wildlife is under increasing threat from illegal mining and timber harvesting and charcoal production. Elkin is also concerned about the Tiang antelope and other animals that make an annual migration between the Bandingalo National Park and the Sud, the huge swamp in South Sudan. About 100,000 Tiang and more than 1 million white-eared cob and Mongolia gazelle migrate through areas where conflict is taking place.
You know, we hope that they can change their patterns if they're confronted with heavy poaching, but we're not sure that they can.
Elkin suggests safety corridors could be established for wildlife migrations, the way humanitarian corridors are for food aid. He says he hopes wildlife and natural resource conservation can be made part of South Sudan's peace process. The aerial survey was funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development and Microsoft co-founder Paul G. Allen. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This week, we're taking a musical journey into African classics. Who are they? What songs, what voices bring back sweet memories of the past? Playlist is amazing, guaranteed to stir your emotions. And some of your own suggestions from Facebook Live are included too. So join me this Sunday and the following Saturday and reconnect with the classics. It's Music Time in Africa, 15 and 2000 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com. On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.